Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, June 23, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a courthouse steps decision case on Sessions v. Morales, a Supreme Court decision which came out on Monday. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Kurt Levy, President of the Committee for Justice and Legal Affairs Fellow at FreedomWorks. I'll turn it over to Kurt to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Hi, this is Kurt. Let me just jump right in here. This case was argued, perhaps ironically, the morning after the election. And I say ironically because it deals with immigration. And that was, of course, the most controversial issue during the election. So some of the justices looked a little sad during oral argument, but hopefully they've recovered by now. This case deals with part of the Immigration and Nationality Act that makes it easier for children who are born overseas to an unmarried mother who is a U.S. citizen to acquire citizenship than their counterparts whose unmarried father is the U.S. citizen. I don't want to go into a lot of detail about that, but if the unmarried mother is the citizen, then the only requirement for the child's citizenship is that the mother spent at least 1 year in the U.S. before the child's birth. So basically, they're treated the same as parents who are married, in which both parents are U.S. citizens. And on the other hand, if the unmarried father is the citizen, then the requirement is that he had lived in the United States for at least 10 years before the child's birth, with 5 of those years coming after the age of 14. Now, in the case at hand, basically just missed that requirement because he was in the country for something like 19 years, but I guess it was just before his 19th birthday, so he just missed the 5 years after the age of 14. And that rule treats the plaintiff here the same as if his parents were a married couple with one spouse a citizen and the other an alien. So again, that's not as preferential as you get if the citizen parent had been the mother. Now, Congress did amend this law in 86 to make it a little better for fathers. They reduced the requirement from 10 years to 5 years, but that's still discriminatory, still get less preferential treatment. And besides, the law that's in effect when you're born is the law that applies. So, you know, you may be wondering how often does this come up. Just to give you a ballpark idea, the attorney for Morales Santana, the immigrant, or I should really say the resident, since he was a legal resident, estimated that there'd be about 100,000 people who would qualify for citizenship above and beyond if you use the mother's rule for the fathers. I should point out that this same issue was before the court. I think it was around 2010. Kagan was recused because of her work as Solicitor General. It ultimately resulted in a 4-4 tie, and so we didn't have a Supreme Court ruling. So it came before the court again in a slightly different posture in this case, involving Luis Ramon Morales Santana, who was born in the Dominican Republic in 1962. He only had one of his two unmarried parents was a U.S. citizen. That was his father, and as I say, the father fell just short of the 5 years after the age of 14. Morales, I'll just call him Morales for short, moved to the U.S. and became a lawful resident at the age of 13. And as far as I know, didn't care much about citizenship, but it became a crucial issue when the federal government initiated proceedings to deport him after he had a series of criminal convictions. And at that point, Morales countered that he was a citizen because his father had been one, and you know, men should not be differentially treated. So he lost that claim before the Board of Immigration Appeals, appealed to the Second Circuit, which ruled in his favor, found a constitutional violation, did what's called leveling down. So they took the mother's standard and applied it to fathers, and said that he was a citizen, and that was basically what I was asking for there. The federal government asked for and got cert, and well, you knew it was going to be at least as far as the constitutional ruling. You knew it was going to be you know, they were going to find a violation when, you know, as soon as you knew that Ginsburg was the author. I mean, you know, it's clear why she got this opinion. She has not just a history of challenging these gender distinctions before she became a judge, but she was involved in one way or another with almost all the early precedential cases. You know, a lot of the cases that she cites in the opinion are, you know, like I say, her cases. Ultimately, you had, and I, you know, it was clear during oral argument that you know, most of the justices agreed there was a constitutional violation, which I guess is interesting in and of itself, given that it was split 4-4 the last time. So 6 of the 8 justices ultimately, you know, joined the, and I say 8 because Gorsuch took no part, 6 of the 8 joined Ginsburg's opinion, and said there was a constitutional violation. There was a very short concurrence by Thomas that was joined by Alito. I'll get to that in a moment. The court also agreed with the Second Circuit on the standing issue, and that is that Morales satisfied the requirement for third-party standing here, that is standing to assert his father's right to equal protection due to the close relationship that he has with his father, and also his father's inability to assert it since his father has since passed away. Ginsburg's majority opinion was pretty straightforward. You know, she explained that laws that treat men and women differentially are subject to heightened scrutiny, and that is they're constitutional only if they serve an important governmental objective, so a little bit less than compelling government objective, and there's a close fit between the objective and, you know, the method that is chosen by Congress to achieve it, and, you know, again, that pretty much parallels the strict scrutiny standard, except, again, they use a little bit different words. Instead of narrow tailoring, it's close fit. Instead of compelling interest, it's important governmental objective. This, you know, this standard should be clear to you going back at least as far as U.S. v. Virginia, the VMI case that struck down VMI's mail-only admissions policy. A lot of people refer to this as intermediate scrutiny, but the court, for the most part, doesn't like to use that term. It says heightened scrutiny, i.e. not really committing itself to what level, but I think we all know what level it is. Court did add that, you know, because here, you know, one of the questions was, you know, are we talking about the intent of Congress 60 or so years ago when it enacted this, or, you know, what Congress would do today? And so the court emphasized that the government objective must, you know, be one that applies to today. So the government didn't really do, in my point of view, a great job of, you know, of putting forth defenses. I guess there just really weren't a lot for something that was blatantly discriminatory. You probably don't have to be a lawyer to know that they're pretty weak. One was that they wanted to treat mothers, Congress wanted to treat mothers differently because our country wants to ensure that a child born overseas has a strong enough connection to the U.S. Again, the implication there is that somehow a father would not provide a strong a connection, and it really doesn't make sense. I mean, if that was even their concern, that the connection to the U.S. is strong enough, then why with a mother is 1 year of ties to the U.S. enough? The second reason they gave seemed even weaker. They just said that there's a desire to have children born outside the U.S. Or they're concerned that children born outside the U.S. to unmarried parents would be stateless, would wind up with, you know, no citizenship anywhere at all. You know, again, it's very hard to see why that would apply more to mothers, you know, such that we have to, you know, make sure that we give them American citizenship than to fathers. And, you know, there was no hearings, congressional hearings or reports to, you know, even indicate that statelessness had anything to do with why Congress enacted this. So basically, you know, both fell very flat. Ginsburg referred to, you know, the standard, basically concluded that this differential treatment was, I think her words were, stunningly anachronistic. And, you know, I guess I have to agree. It just doesn't seem like, other than, you know, a tradition born in, you know, very different gender roles 60 or more years ago, just, you know, hasn't been changed. You know, the government now tries to come up with modern sounding, you know, rationales. But again, this dates back to a time when, you know, there really was the notion that an unwed mother, you know, should be and was the sole guardian of the child, and that fathers didn't care much about the kids and didn't have much contact with them. So again, this is, you know, consistent with a long line of cases going back almost 50 years, going back really to Reed. Reed v. Reed in 71, which struck down a probate code preference for a father over a mother as the administrator of a deceased child's estate. Really, ever since then, the court has, you know, used terminology like Ginsburg used here for, you know, overbroad generalizations about the, you know, different preferences or abilities of men and women. And the court did point out that in this case, you know, those generalizations can actually be harmful in two ways. You know, one, they perpetuate the stereotype that, you know, requires women to assume the role of primary family caregiver, which, you know, they may not want to assume. And then it also works against men who, you know, are trying hard to be good fathers. So, again, I thought the most interesting thing here was just that all the cases that Ginsburg needed to rely on were ones that, you know, she had been involved in, you know, several that she had argued. So again, the majority opinion with six votes was pretty straightforward. The concurrence was that Thomas wrote and Alito joined was short. They just said that they agreed that there really was no basis for, and here I'm going to sort of, I guess, ruin the surprise and tell you that the court did not think that it could level down, did not think it could provide the plaintiff with the one-year standard that was applied to the unwed citizen mother. And Thomas said that he agreed with that and that therefore the court couldn't give Morales the relief he sought and, you know, that therefore it didn't need to decide whether there were, you know, whether the differential requirements were constitutional. It didn't even think it needed to decide the standing question. So that's why it was a very short opinion. Now, it's interesting. So the concurrence sort of treats it as that they were deciding one question and that once you say he can't get the relief, you know, it's over. And yet the court referred to itself at the very end. Ginsburg opinion says that they're reversing in part and affirming in part, you know, affirming the unconstitutionality, but reversing with regard to the remedy. So that almost sounds like she views it as two questions. I mean, ultimately, that has no practical significance, but I did kind of find that a little bit interesting. So anyway, in terms of remedy, the two most obvious things to do were level up or level down. The court chose to level up, i.e. ultimately to apply the harsher standard to both mothers and fathers. And that was unusual. The court did acknowledge that usually it levels down, you know, if only because that seems fairer to most people. So I think the fact that they, and again, I'll get into it in a second, why they chose to level up, but I think the fact that they did, you know, could have some precedential value for doing that in the future. Now, you know, at again, it, this question about remedy, all you know, was pretty clear that was going to be the big question at oral argument. Like I say, most of the justices seemed to agree that there was a constitutional violation. There was less agreement on the remedy. And, you know, I mean, there was agreement at oral argument that the court should try to determine what Congress would have wanted to do if it had known the, you know, that it couldn't have two different standards. The problem was the justices couldn't really agree on, you know, which Congress we were talking about. The Congress, you know, back in the first half of the 19th century or the current Congress. Roberts thought it was the old Congress. He said you're not really talking about Congress's intent in the statute if you look at the current Congress. Ginsburg, on the other hand, said, you know, how can you look to that old Congress when you know, that's the, you know, that Congress took a completely you know, non-equal approach to the genders. So ultimately they never really you know, answered that question. And again, somewhat unusual what they did. They did acknowledge that it, you know, to the extent that there's a precedent, it's to level down. The problem here, I think everyone agrees, is that if you extend the more lenient requirement, the 1 year, to everyone, then you wind up giving unmarried parents a better deal than the case where you have married parents and only one is a citizen. And that seems neither fair nor what Congress, you know, that couldn't be what Congress intended. Now, I do remember at oral argument, Ginsburg said that might not be a problem because, you know, this case is about gender discrimination. It's not about, you know, marital status. So it, in some sense, it doesn't matter if you're giving the unwed couple better treatment than the wed couple where one is an alien. But again, I think that's an overly narrow way to look at it, and I guess she eventually became convinced of it because it's really about, you know, is leveling down something that Congress would do? And no, it wouldn't if it resulted in something that seems so unfair to people. So the court did say that it was doing, you know, that it was doing the leveling up on an interim basis, that is, until Congress can step in and come up with some, you know, uniform handling of the citizen mother and the citizen father. But of course, that could be never, you know, especially given Congress's ability to agree on the immigration law. I remember at oral argument, Kagan said something which sounded like it had a little more teeth in it in terms of pushing Congress to act. She noted another case, I can't remember which it was, where the justices had, you know, issued their ruling but stayed the judgment to give Congress a chance to do it a different way and put a little pressure on Congress. Not sure why they didn't do it that way here, except that I also remember that the Morales's attorney didn't like that idea either. He felt like you had to address the constitutional violation. Nonetheless, it didn't get addressed for Morales. I mean, maybe it will be in the near future. So it really was a hollow victory for Morales. This case probably doesn't, it doesn't break new ground on the differential treatment based on gender. So it probably doesn't add much to the law. It is consistent with a long line of cases. So, I mean, it just reinforces the obvious. Again, it might have some precedential value for remedies in that what they did was unusual. Again, I'm not quite sure what the precedent would be. I suppose you could state it as it's, fine to level up when leveling down would be something that, Congress just wouldn't have done. I think I'm going to stop. There are some implications beyond, this narrow issue, but I think I'll leave. I've probably talked long enough, so I'll leave that for the questions round, and I guess I'll just open it up for questions.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our first question, I'll ask one of my own. Are there any implications from this case that apply to the travel ban?
Yeah, I mean, that's what everyone, given that this was a somewhat lackluster end to the term, I think even apart from this case, people seem to be more interested in, when is the court going to tell us what it's doing on the travel ban than they were in a lot of these decisions. But this one, I think, does have some implications. One of the cases that the government pointed to in arguing for a lesser degree of scrutiny was, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, Fiallo v. Bell, which dates back 40 years. On its face, it's very similar. It involves unwed fathers and their children asserting equal protection rights to the same, unlike the case here where Morales had been in the country for a long time. In this case, it's preferences in, for immigration to unwed mothers and their children. And what's interesting is that the Morales court, and let me read this because I think I don't want to, I think it's worthy of sort of considering every word. It said, applying rational basis review, the Fiallo court upheld the provision relying on Congress's exceptionally broad power to admit or exclude aliens. So it upheld the differential treatment 40 years ago, and again, relying on Congress's exceptionally broad power to admit or exclude aliens. Now, by that description, you would definitely say that Fiallo is certainly relevant to what's the appropriate standard of review in cases where, some categorical exclusion of aliens is said to be discriminatory. Now, the court distinguished Fiallo in an interesting way. And again, let me just read it. It says, this case, however, involves no entry preference for aliens. Morales Santana claims he is, and since birth has been, a U.S. citizen. So, again, that's not the case with the travel ban. The travel ban is more like Fiallo. So if that's an important distinction, then, the lower standard of review would apply to travel ban. I think that's particularly significant because if you look back at Fiallo and names escaping me, but the case that relied heavily on, it wasn't, I'd say rational basis would be a charitable description. It really was very close to non-reviewable. Again, let me read you some actual language. There's a bunch of these in Fiallo, but one says that policy questions in immigration are entrusted exclusively to the political branches. Another says that complaints about invidious stereotypes where aliens are concerned, quote, should be addressed to the Congress rather than the courts. So what was Ginsburg doing here, you know, if anything, with Fiallo? I mean, maybe she was trying to recast Fiallo as rational basis rather than standing for virtual non-reviewability because she's sympathetic. You know, she doesn't like the travel ban, and she thought, okay, rational basis, you know, maybe the challengers can win. Non-reviewable is non-reviewable. But I mean, even if you think that's what she's up to, you know, her paragraph on Fiallo has to be encouraging for the Trump administration for the reasons that I just alluded to. So again, I don't want to read too much. You know, it's just about a paragraph or so in the opinion about Fiallo, but I do think there's little tidbits there.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our next question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Monday, June 26th at 3 p.m. Eastern. That call will be a Courthouse Steps Teleform on the case Ziegler v. Abbasi, which was decided by the Supreme Court on Monday. That call will feature David Rifkin, partner at Baker & Hostetler. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are our podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'm not seeing any questions from the audience. I'll ask another. Was this decision, did people expect it to come out this way, or is this a surprise?
Well, not a surprise in terms of finding a constitutional violation. Like I said, you know, most of the justices seem to agree on that at oral argument. A bit of a surprise with regard to remedy. You know, it's not that there was some other expectation, but the justices really couldn't seem to agree on a remedy at oral argument. And there was some expression of concern at oral argument that where there's a constitutional violation, there should be some remedy. So a little bit of a surprise that, you know, ultimately they leveled up. I mean, I think people were sort of hoping there'd be some, you know, magic solution where, okay, people accepted leveling down would be a weird result that Congress wouldn't intend. Leveling up wasn't quite fair. I know I came away thinking that they'd come up with something more clever. Instead, what they came up with was telling Congress to act. I mean, that is the, I suppose that is the right remedy if Congress would act, but, you know, I'm not very hopeful that that Congress will act here. I mean, one, it's very divided on immigration, and two, I don't think they get a lot of brownie points. I mean, if they were, I mean, to be very blunt, if this was discriminating against women, they could, you know, like say their Ledbetter legislation, they, you know, could spout off about it for years to come. But the fact that they're, you know, that they're correcting discrimination against men, I think would probably of a little less value to them. And in this, they're helping out someone who does have a number of criminal convictions. So is there a chance Congress will just do it because it's the right thing to do? Yeah, I think there is. But I do feel sorry for Morales. I mean, you know, he has in some sense a big victory, but in another sense, he's, you know, got very little to show for it. Now, of course, there is the possibility of some sort of, I mean, I should point out there is the possibility of some sort of, you know, prosecutorial discretion here. I mean, maybe that's the fairest thing to do is just ultimately not go ahead with, you know, kicking him out of the country. I mean, I would, I'd certainly be fine with that.
I'll make a final call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any, would you like to make any final remarks?
No, I mean, I guess I would just add that there are, you know, other areas of the law where differential treatment of men and women is sort of, well, we really don't know what the standard is. I mean, it's been a long time since the court addressed differential treatment of men and women in private employment under Title VII in the Johnson case. And, you know, it really would be interesting to see what the new standard was. I'm sure the court, you know, just like it's to some degree been avoiding telling us what the Title VII standard is for racial preferences. Now, it's not entirely the court's fault. I mean, to some degree, it's you know, the civil rights community trying to settle those cases, as in the Taxman case in New Jersey. But I don't think the court's in any great hurry to apply Title VII to, you know, update Title VII with regard to race or gender. So I certainly didn't mean to say that, you know, the whole issue of gender classifications is solved and there's no new ground to be broken. It's just that when it comes to these government classifications, I think it's pretty clear now what the standard is, and you'd have to think that Congress, you know, won't enact many more of these, if any, just because they really do represent an old way of, you know, thinking about the roles of men and women and mothers and fathers. And I think that would be my final thought.
Great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.